From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Keystone XL pipeline would have moved 800,000 barrels of oil a day from Canada's tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. It became a huge symbolic battleground over energy and climate change. On Friday, President Obama said no to the pipeline. Supporters say it's not over. Many environmentalists say they've got bigger fish to fry. So what just happened? This hour on Point, climate and Canada's tar sands after the Keystone decision. Here was the president Friday rejecting the Keystone pipeline but saying, look, too much may have been made of this in both directions.
For years, the Keystone pipeline has occupied what I frankly consider an overinflated role in our political discourse. It became a symbol too often used as a campaign cudgel by both parties rather than a serious policy matter. And all of this obscured the fact that this pipeline would neither be a silver bullet for the economy, as was promised by some, nor the express lane to climate disaster proclaimed by others.
But the president said it was time to act, and rejecting the pipeline was the kind of action America needs to be seen as a global leader on climate change.
America is now a global leader when it comes to taking serious action to fight climate change. And frankly, approving this project would have undercut that global leadership. And that's the biggest risk we face. Not acting.
But opposition, plenty. Here was Chris Christie with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday.
This president is a radical environmental liberal. And when I'm president, we'll build the Keystone Pipeline if the Canadians are still interested.
Well, we'll see. In this hour, we'll go to Canada. We'll talk with a leading environmental reporter and talk with Bill McKibben, who led the fight against Keystone. But first, let's go to Fort Pierre, South Dakota, and Republican U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. He was a supporter of the Keystone Pipeline, which would have snaked right through his home state. Senator Rounds, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Well, we're okay. It won't happen, at least won't happen now. Do you think the Keystone Pipeline is dead, Senator Rounds?
No, I don't. I think this is a delay, but the project is still a good business plan. It will save consumers money in the end. It's a more efficient way to deliver oil to refineries that are designed to refine that type of oil. And long term, it will prevail. But in the meantime, it'll simply be delayed. We'll have more rail cars delivering it, which will add, if we're really worried about climate change and carbon dioxide, it would have been a much more efficient way to use a pipeline rather than to still continue to use rail cars. In South Dakota, it means that we'll have more congestion on the rail lines. It means it'll be difficult to get our crops to market, and it'll add cost to producing food and fiber for the American public.
If a Republican is elected president, do you expect the Keystone XL pipeline to be back on the table, to be built?
I do. And the reason is that it is an appropriate business model. That oil will be utilized one way or another. We'll either do it efficiently and as cleanly as possible in the United States in our refineries, or other countries will purchase it, and they will do it in their refineries. And it's not necessarily under the same environmental critiques as what we have here in the United States. It's not just Canadian oil which is coming through the pipeline. Out of the 830,000 barrels a day that would come through, approximately 8 to 10% is also a light sweet crude coming out of the Bakken in North Dakota. We'd much rather be able to utilize North American crude than to import crude from other parts of the world.
But of course, the main point is to take it out of Canada and get it down there, as you say, to be refined in refineries that can handle that. The tar sands oil, Senator Rounds, has been called the dirtiest oil in the world, and many people are now saying, if we want the planet to survive, not have so much climate change that we fry, we're going to have to leave a bunch of fossil fuels in the ground. And it's not just environmental extremists, as Chris Christie would have it, saying that anymore. Do you agree, or do you think we're going to pump the last drop of oil out of the earth, no matter how dirty it might be?
I think this oil will be utilized because we still have a demand for oil, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it as efficiently and as cleanly as possible. We are more capable of doing that than other countries in the world. Anybody that thinks that the people that own that product aren't going to pull that product out of the ground, I believe, are wrong.
Does it make sense at $40-something dollars a barrel? Does it still make sense, sir?
No, and in this particular case, the folks who put this business plan together looked at this long term, looked at it for 25 to 50 years. This isn't something that's going to be taken in and out in just 5 years. This is a long-term project. We're going to continue to need oil resources throughout the world, not only for the near future, but for the foreseeable future. So that product will be utilized one way or another. It's simply a matter of, do we want to participate and control it in the most effective and environmentally appropriate manner, or do we want another country to control it? That product will be utilized one way or another.
Are you? What makes you so sure of that? If prices stay down at this level, do you really think it will be the same depth of development of Canada's tar sands that might have been imagined when oil was 100 plus a barrel?
You know, I think right now, even the folks here in the United States had estimated that the cost of crude would be well over $89 a barrel. This will be short term. It won't last that long. We're going to see oil go back up again. It's not going to stay at $45 a barrel. But in the meantime, it's almost like a savings account for the folks that own that product and those reserves, not just in Canada, but in North Dakota as well. They're not going to produce as much of it at $45 a barrel as they will when it starts to move back up again. But it will be utilized because demand for that product will continue to grow as more and more people around the world need those petroleum resources. And, you know, this is a case of where we're going to continue to burn oil. We're going to continue to use it in our aircraft. We're going to continue to use it in our road building. We're going to continue to use it literally in the vehicles that we drive. Now, we're going to do more of other types, and that's good. But you're still going to utilize the oil coming out of not just North Dakota, but Canada as well.
For the
we
climate,
just want to do it as efficiently as possible.
You may be right, but for the climate, for the environment, for your grandkids and mine and everybody else's, would we be better off leaving these, and they are dirty, fossil fuels in the ground?
Well, I think if you take a look at what you call dirty, you're talking about a particular type of oil.
Yeah.
And you've got to have the right type of a refinery in order to utilize it. We've got those refineries that were designed.
Would we be better off leaving it in the ground for your grandkids?
Would we be better off leaving it in the ground? It depends on what it does to our economy. You know, if we have a strong economy and we're utilizing energy resources as best we can, and if we keep our economy strong compared to the rest of the world, we're in a better position to actually negotiate and come up with good programs to clean the environment, to take care of the environment. If we don't have a strong economy, a very strong economy, we're less likely to be in a position to do that. You take a look at the rest of the developing world, and for those places that don't have a good, strong economy, those are the places that are saying, gee, we got to catch up. We need more liberal interpretations of these environmental rules, because we got to get caught up with you developed countries. You take a look around the world at the third world countries, and each of them is saying, gee, you've already got your stuff developed, and now you expect us to live by your environmental standards, and they're rejecting that.
Yeah,
and in fact, look at any one of the proposals that's been out there so far. Anybody that did not have a good, strong economy is not being expected to live under the same environmental conditions as we're proposing to do to ourselves.
And here we are making decisions about energy and the climate in the year 2015. United States Senator Mike Rounds, Republican, junior senator from South Dakota, joins us from Fort Pierre, South Dakota today. Thank you very much, Senator Rounds.
Tom, a pleasure to visit with you.
Now from Middlebury, Vermont, Bill McKibben joins us, environmentalist, author, co-founder of 350.org, environmental group that was right at the heart of the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. Bill McKibben, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Tom, always good to be with you, friend.
So did you just win the big one, or has this become a sideshow? The president said everybody's been making too much of this, even as he rejected it.
Well, the president wasn't really very happy, I guess, that we forced this decision on him. But in fact, this is the first time that any world leader has turned down a major fossil fuel project because of its effect on the climate. It's an enormous victory for the broadest environmental coalition that's gathered around any issue in the last 20 or 30 years. Yes, we did have to go, you know, sit in at the president's house, and we're sorry if we caused him offense, but we're glad that in the end he came around not only to block the pipeline, but to do it in just the right terms, to make the point that some In fact, most fossil fuel that we know about needs to remain underground if we're going to have any chance of even beginning to slow down the disastrous pace of climate change. And that's what was interesting about your conversation with Senator Rounds. Look, the amount of misinformation that's been spewed out in the course of this whole debate's enormous. The first thing to be said is that oil isn't going to come out of the tar sands now. It's not going to come out on trains. They're carrying out only the tiniest, tiniest bit on train cars because it adds $15 or $20 a barrel to the cost. As the industry itself has said, without these pipelines, it cannot carry out its plan to double, triple, quadruple production in the Canadian tar sands. In fact, investors, even before the price of oil began to drop last year, pulled out tens of billions of dollars from new expansion plans up there precisely because they couldn't get a pipeline. That was the reason that Shell gave 2 weeks ago when it pulled out $2 billion worth of new planned expansion.
So, Bill, if there's a Republican president, do you think Keystone will be back on the table?
Oh, I'm sure that, you know, the day that Chris Christie is in the White House, should that day come, you know, he'll announce plans for the Super Patriot, Happy Freedom, all the oil you can eat pipeline, you know, pouring down out of Canada, and anybody, you know, several of his competitors as well. But I don't think it's going to happen because I think the world is making a decisive turn in the direction of renewable energy.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the world and its climate and Canada's tar sands after President Obama's Keystone Pipeline decision. On Friday, of course, the president said no to the pipeline. In March of last year, Bill McKibben's operation, 350.org, led over 1,000 students in a protest against the Keystone Pipeline. Here they are chanting in front of the White House gates.
Hey, Obama, we don't want no pipeline drama. Hey, Obama, we don't.
On Friday, after 7 years of review, the president said, no, can't do it. The earth can't take it.
If we're going to prevent large parts of this earth from becoming not only inhospitable but uninhabitable in our lifetimes, we're going to have to keep some fossil fuels in the ground rather than burn them and release more dangerous pollution into the sky.
Bill McKibben helped lead the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. He's with us from Middlebury, Vermont. Coral Davenport joins us in a moment. Bill, I want to get a view from Canada here for a second. Campbell Clark is with us, chief political writer for the Globe and Mail, joining us from Ottawa. Campbell Clark, say hi to Bill McKibben and welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bill.
Hey.
Campbell, what do Canadians think? Do they think that it will ever be built? Do they think that, do Canadians think that the tar sands will be exploited, pulled out, refined anyway?
I think most Canadians probably feel that there will be oil flowing from what we call the oil sands, what you tend to call the tar sands, for a long time, and that it will probably expand. But I think there's a lot of doubt now about the pace of that expansion. You know, there's other pipeline projects. There's others, you know, being in the approval stages or about to be approved stages other than Keystone. So it's not the only one, but this is having an impact in Canada. You know, it's not only fueled questions from some people about, you know, how do we get oil to market, but it's fueled a lot of calls for action on climate change, not necessarily calls to keep that oil in the ground, though.
Is the president, President Obama, being criticized or praised or both? What's the range or weight of response there?
So if you think that this was a big political issue in the United States, it's become a touchstone in Canada that was constantly talked about in terms of Canada-U.S. relations. So the government here is trying to move on. You know, it's been a psychodrama for Canada-U.S. relations. So, you know, they're basically saying we're disappointed, but we understand this, you know, the right to make this decision, we'll move on. Across the country, some people, especially people who were, you know, in favor of this pipeline or in favor of oil sands development, are criticizing Mr. Obama quite vociferously. You know, you got to remember, we just changed governments, right?
So from Stephen Harper to Justin Trudeau.
Correct, yeah. So the previous government would have been livid, and the people that supported them are. They think that this, or they say this was, you know, a purely political decision that was, you know, based on who supported Mr. Obama, the kind of sort of legacy he wanted to leave in political terms, but not on the practical matters. That's the kind of, you know, this was a cheap shot against Canada criticism that he is getting in Canada. Others, though, are sort of saying, you know, we should have learned our lesson and we should have done something about climate change long ago. And if we had been acting on climate change, then this pipeline would have been such a symbol of inaction in Canada.
Bill McKibben, do you, as an environmental activist and leader on that front, feel like you've got leverage on Canada? I mean, the pipeline looked like a big piece of leverage. Now there may be other pipelines, and there's still, of course, you know, people who are going to want, who have invested and want to develop those sands.
Oh, yeah. The people who have invested and want to develop those tar sands are the people, for instance, who fund Senator Rounds, who's taken $308,000 in oil industry money. It's the Koch brothers who are the largest leaseholders in the tar sands in Canada, for instance. The leverage is not ours. There are people, as Colin knows, all across Canada deeply engaged in this battle. The Northern Gateway pipeline out of the tar sands is all but dead. The Energy East pipeline that would head east out of the tar sands is now the subject of a huge fight across Quebec and Ontario. There were 4 days of big sit-ins over the last 4 days to welcome, there was a climate welcome for the new Prime Minister Trudeau. But I think also, Tom, you run the risk of over-focus. I mean, the real story, mm-hmm. what happened with Keystone, is not just that we were able to slow dramatically the expansion of the tar sands in Canada. It's that now every fossil fuel infrastructure project on the continent and increasingly around the planet is now under the same kind of siege. Earlier this year, a fossil fuel industry executive speaking at a conference said to his colleagues in a kind of beleaguered tone, we have to figure out a way to stop the Keystoneization of every project that we have. Now, that's, from our point of view, very good news. What we're doing increasingly is holding the fossil fuel industry in check. And while we do it, every month that passes, the solar engineers bring down the cost of a panel another 2 or 3%. They're being undercut and hit hard from both sides. And it's no wonder, you know, that the Koch brothers feel they're going to have to spend $900 million on our next election. Their position is threatened as it's never threatened before.
Campbell, I know I've just got you for another minute. Do you feel that change in the wind? You're a political writer there, chief
yeah.
political writer there. Can you feel a change in the political environment that's going to put big fossil fuel infrastructure projects up against tough opposition consistently?
So there have been up against tough opposition consistently in Canada for a long time. There are several pipeline projects. There is a change in the wind politically here, but I should point out that the opposition to pipelines is mostly, well, sorry, not always in Canada, about keeping the oil in the ground. It's often about local concerns, you know, First Nations lands, mm-hmm. running tankers off the coasts of British Columbia, you know, things like that, but, you know, more like the concerns we saw in Nebraska. So, yes, there's a political change. There's talk about action to combat greenhouse gas emissions that I think has a real push for that politically in Canada now. But I'm not sure. I don't think the opposition to pipelines is what in Canada what it is in the United States.
Campbell Clark with the Globe and Mail in Ottawa, Canada, chief political writer there. Thank you very much for joining us, Campbell.
Thank you.
Bill McKibben calls for you. Jake in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Jake, you're on the air with Bill McKibben.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to say that I think Republicans are playing a very cynical game here. There are so many factors, including eminent domain, being thrust upon farmers for basically the corporate welfare of a Canadian corporation. It's insane. It's insane. Like, if we want to lead the world in, like, climate change and reversing the problem that we led the world into, we have to do things like this. We have to lead by example. I mean, there's no other way around it. That senator that you had on earlier
yes.
is kidding himself. Yeah,
this is
Jake, I appreciate your call, Bill.
I think that's so right. Look at the really interesting coalition, Tom, that formed around this Keystone thing. There were climate scientists like Jim Hansen who pointed out that if you pumped all the economically recoverable oil out of the tar sands of Canada, there's so much that it would be, as he put it, game over for the climate. But there were also really remarkable leadership from First Nations people on both sides of the border, from farmers and ranchers in especially Nebraska, who mounted an all-out defense. It was around climate, it was around pollution, and as the caller points out, it was around the obscenity of a corporation being allowed to use eminent domain to take their land to build a completely unnecessary pipeline. So this is the kind of obstacle now that the fossil fuel industry increasingly faces. And it'll become more so with each passing week. Look, 2015 is the hottest year that human beings have ever recorded. We're now in a period of real danger that gets worse with each passing month. And that alone will drive this momentum in this direction. Even if we didn't also have the accompanying fact that as at exactly the same time, renewable energy is finally getting cheap enough to compete. If we put a price on carbon, which every economist left, right, and center has said for a quarter century we should do, then this battle would have been over long, long ago. But even with the fossil fuel industry allowed to pour its waste into the atmosphere for free, its proposition gets weaker with each passing year.
One more call. We'll bring Coral Davenport and Chris in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. We've had two train derailments in Wisconsin in the past week. One dumped a whole bunch of petroleum products into the Mississippi River, which is probably not a good thing.
Probably not.
And the other one was in Watertown, Wisconsin, with that pile of sludge that they're hauling across our state. And there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not we should allow that to. I'm not making an argument for the pipeline. I would like the government to get into buying solar panels for everybody on the planet so that we can just get off the grid and stop doing this stuff.
Are you confident that's going to happen, Chris? Does the Keystone Pipeline seem like a step in that direction or not?
Something has to happen. Like, why are we giving all this money to the Koch brothers so that they can shovel it back into our political process and corrupt that? This isn't making any sense. It's not logical.
Chris, I appreciate your call as well. Thank you very much. Bill, stand by. Coral Davenport joins us right now from Washington, energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Coral, welcome back to One Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
How do you? I mean, you cover all of this. You're watching what's coalescing around the world headed toward Paris and the big climate conference there next month. How do you see the significance in CO2 terms and in symbolic terms of the president's decision on Friday, Coral?
The biggest part of the president's decision was clearly symbolic. He touched at that in his remarks from the White House. He talked about how sort of on both sides, the whole question of the Keystone Pipeline has been elevated to symbolic significance far more than its actual substance, either in terms of its impact on the climate or its impact on the economy. The president wants to go into these Paris climate negotiations starting at the end of this month, sending a signal to the rest of the world that the U.S. is serious about climate change. He wants this as a legacy issue. He wants to go into Paris and get a really strong accord and kind of tie a bow on it and have that be a big part of his legacy. But in terms of substance, the president actually has moved forward on a lot of really substantial systemic climate policies. This is one infrastructure project. If this stood as the president's actual climate policy, it would be nothing.
You're talking about everything he's done with auto emissions, what he's got on the table now for power plant emissions.
Exactly. Those are a lot harder to kind of wrap your head around. They don't translate well into, you can't take a proposed regulation on future power plants and wrap that around the White House. It's hard to, quickly translate that into a political soundbite or an ad. But those are the real substantive climate policies that the administration has moved forward with. It's almost bizarre how, this one particular pipeline ended up getting elevated into the symbol of climate or energy that it has.
Of course, the argument gets made. This was in addition to its practical impact, whatever its scale, this was a way to coalesce around opposition, as Bill McKibben says, to fossil fuel infrastructure. I want to look at that and more. We're talking about the Keystone decision. I mean, it's interesting to look back. Here's a little clip from President Obama. This is in 2012, and he was in Cushing, Oklahoma, talking about his support for the pipeline.
Right now, a company called TransCanada has applied to build a new pipeline to speed more oil from Cushing to state-of-the-art refineries down in the Gulf Coast. And today I'm directing my administration to cut through the red tape, break through the bureaucratic hurdles, and make this project a priority, to go ahead and get it done.
Of course, it did not get done. Bill McKibben, you have played no small part in that. What turned that around? How did you turn this president?
Well, I think what happened was that millions of people turned out. And what they said was, this pipeline is absolutely the symbol of everything that is wrong with our climate policy, that we continue to dig up every last scrap of coal, gas, and oil that there is and burn it, and that it doesn't make any difference, you know, what our demand-side policies are, the kind of things that Coral's talking about, if we're not also keeping in the ground the fossil fuels that we have. Think about what's happened over the 5 or 6 years of that fight. In that time, this keep it in the ground idea has spread so widely that last week it was Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, speaking in Lloyd's of London, who was using exactly this language, saying there's now huge risk to the stranded assets from unburnable carbon.
A business risk, but rooted in this insight.
Rooted in the planetary risk. We can't burn this stuff. That's what people are saying. And in fact, that's what the editors of the New York Times said in a really beautiful editorial a few hours after this decision came down. The editorial was headlined, "No to Keystone, Yes to the Planet." The constant attempt to sort of say that activists don't count and this kind of – it's just wrong. In the last few months, not only this, but the remarkable work that people did to help drive Shell out of the Arctic and now put the Arctic off limits to drilling. As we meet today outside the White House, there are thousands of young people in this Our Generation, Our Choice, Civil Disobedience, demanding action in Boston over the weekend. There they were helping shut down the plans for the Spectra pipeline going right through West Roxbury. Today, I'm just thinking about sort of where your studio is, Tom. You know, a couple of miles on the other side of that at MIT, there are students in day 17 of a sit-in to demand divestment, a movement that's now grown to encompass $2.6 trillion worth of portfolios and endowments around the world, including the biggest sovereign wealth fund on the planet in Norway, including the largest insurance company in France, including the Rockefeller family, including the Anglican Church, including you name it. This movement is on a remarkable roll, and Washington and others will slowly, painfully respond to it. But and I don't know whether they'll respond in time. I mean, as we're saying this, the second huge hurricane cyclone in a week has pounded into the coast of Yemen, which has never had a hurricane pound into it before. We're in a horrible hole, but when you're in a hole, the first rule is stop digging.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world and its climate and Canada's tar sands after the president's Keystone Pipeline decision. On Friday, of course, he said no after 7 years of review. Environmentalists were out in some force on Friday chanting in thanks to the president for the rejection of Keystone.
Thank you, Mr. President! Thank you, Mr. President! Thank you!
And here on Friday, Democratic Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey talked on PBS NewsHour, praised the decision on Keystone, cited the importance of setting an example leading up to the Paris climate talks in December.
You cannot preach temperance from a bar stool. If the United States is going to be in Paris, you can't be telling the rest of the world to be reducing your greenhouse gases while simultaneously saying that we're going to allow for a pipeline to be built with big environmental issues, carrying the dirtiest oil in the world.
But here's Jeb Bush on Friday talking with Fox Business, saying all this does the country, the United States, no good.
The irony is the carbon footprint will be bigger with the alternatives than what it would have been to integrate this into the Gulf Coast. This will raise prices for America, not lower prices, and it will have a bigger environmental impact, a negative impact, and lost jobs, lost income, disrespecting our largest trading partner. All of this does not do the country good.
Carl Davenport, what about the tar sands and their future development? What are you hearing about what's likely there? Will this stuff just be taken out by train and truck anyway, or is it indeed likely to substantially stay in the ground?
Well, that has mostly to do with the state of the global oil market. Getting the oil out of the tar sands is very expensive. It's harder to get out. It costs more. It adds more to the cost of the oil to get it out.
See why. You look at the pictures. They got to strip all that boreal forest away, and it's gooey stuff to move it is hard. So it's expensive.
It's expensive. So when the global price of oil is high, then it's worth it for oil companies to invest that extra money to get the oil out and move it. When the price of oil is low, right now below $50 a barrel, it's more likely to stay in the ground just because it's not financially sustainable. We're seeing a huge boom in the U.S. of production. And that's, you know, and that's having an influence on the price of global of the global oil market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the company that wanted to build the pipeline, TransCanada, put in their applications at a time when oil prices were much higher. They were, as the senator talked about at the top of the hour, thinking about, of course, the long-term oil markets. Oil markets are notoriously volatile. It's very likely that we'll see prices go back up to as high as $100 a barrel in the coming years. But for the time being, you know, that's really the primary influence on whether that oil gets out of the ground.
This is an important point. That oil is not coming out by rail from the tar sands, no matter the price. I'm looking at the graph right now of rail shipments from Canada to the Gulf Coast and of oil. And Keystone would have carried 800 and some thousand barrels a day, the highest over the last 5 years, even when the price of oil was 100 and some dollars a barrel, is just under 100,000 barrels of oil a day. Now there's essentially none coming out by rail. They needed that pipeline to expand the tar sands. They were talking about tripling and quadrupling the size of the tar sands. That's not happening. People were able to stop that, just as activists this year have been able to stop plans for the largest coal mine in the world in Australia.
And if it goes back to $100 a barrel for oil, Bill, what happens then?
It's not going to come out by train. The tar sands is not going to happen on the scale they thought it was. And by now, everyone, including the Canadian business press, has said that. The investment has just dried up. And it won't come back because as people are beginning to realize, there's a new factor in this fight. Oil's always ridden boom and bust cycles. The difference now is that there's a competitor. The solar panel, the wind turbine are suddenly producing power at astonishingly cheap rates. Since the Keystone fight started, the cost of a solar panel has dropped 80%. That's where investment is going now. That's why the governor of the Bank of England was telling insurance companies, you guys better get your money out of fossil fuel because there is a huge exposure risk.
Coral, Bill's a campaigner, and in that respect, he's an optimist. Do you see the world turning the page on fossil fuel, which is what he's suggesting there?
Well, it will be very interesting to see the outcome of this accord in Paris. We are seeing most of the world's major economies have put forth plans ahead of Paris to, in some cases, significantly reduce their carbon emissions, in other cases not. And the next couple of years will be an interesting turning point to see if we start to see major economies putting a price on carbon emissions, putting in place cap and trade systems, putting in place some form of carbon tax. If we see sort of these changing economic systems in the next few years, that sends a global market signal that you know, to businesses that using fossil fuels is actually going to be more expensive in the long run than using other sources of energy. So it's those market signals that could potentially indicate the, mm-hmm. the turn away from fossil fuels. And we'll see those policies start to emerge. A lot will depend on what in the U.S., what the next president does. President Obama has put in place a set of EPA regulations that would require automakers to build more fuel efficient vehicles, that would require electric utilities to produce lower emissions, to change their fuel sources. The next president will probably, you know, if we want to see that curve continue, the next president would have to do more, would have to both implement those policies and do more. So we'll see this unfold over the next couple of years. The biggest thing to watch for is whether we see the world's biggest economy is moving forward with pricing carbon in some form.
Bob in Oklahoma, Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. Listen, I've been watching this all my life. The first thing that's going to have to happen, if there's going to be any comprehensive plan for sustainable energy mm-hmm. and food production and forest regeneration in the future, in order to have that comprehensive plan, we will have to have a candid discussion, at which time all of this abstractionism, psychobabble that's oriented in politics is going to have to go off the table, and the whole thing is going to have to be brought down to earth.
Let's hear it.
And we're going to have to discuss what is sustainable, how is that going to work, regardless of the Bill Christies, regardless of the psychobabble, and are we going to have a media that's actually going to deal with boots on the ground?
What is psychobabble, Bob, when you're talking about,
psychobabble is, Tom?
Yeah.
It is this continuing conversation that won't allow for the actual conversation of what the energy and agriculture looks like that is sustainable.
And
by farms, by forests,
yeah.
by small communities,
yeah.
by people all over the planet. If we're not going to have that conversation, then the psychobabble just continues.
Are you saying we've got to cut the fossil fuels to be real about sustainability? Is that where you're going, Bob?
Absolutely. Is that not a given fact at this point?
And no, we get it. We get it. But it's
facts.
I totally get it, Bob, but it's a big sumo wrestle here at the same time. Bill.
His point is really good. Look at the other news that came out in the fossil fuel world last week, which was that the New York Attorney General now, and perhaps the Department of Justice to follow, has taken up the fact that ExxonMobil, largest oil company on
yep.
earth, lied, deceived, and disinformed for a quarter century. They underwrote a phony, faux, pretend debate about climate change that they could have ended at any point. That's the psychobabble that really has kept us from getting down to brass tacks. And the time is now, and it is starting to happen. There are countries in the world that are deploying renewable energy at astonishing rates. And if we're able to start bringing the Exxons of the world a little bit to heel, if we're able to break the power of people like the Koch brothers, that'll help. That's one of the things that this fight was about. It was an epic stand against the fossil fuel industry, and it's the first big battle like this that the fossil fuel industry has ever lost. And that means that the tide is beginning to turn.
I hear Bob loud and clear. At the same time, you've got to get out there with your bullhorn and be part of the noise to change the texture of it. We can see from your example, Bill. I mean, is it psychobabble when people wrestle over the politics of energy?
No, I mean it's
it can
that's
be loaded,
what we're doing.
It can be
that's
larded
what we're doing.
With it,
it's
yeah.
incredibly important. But the part that's crazy is just the endless lies and deceptions.
Yeah.
Exxon is the perfect example. As the LA Times and others have now demonstrated with great reporting, they knew as early as the early 1980s exactly what was going on with climate change. By the early 1990s, they were deploying that knowledge in order to buy up drilling rights in the melting Arctic and things like that.
We put them on the air as soon as they came out with it.
At the same time, they were poisoning this debate. I mean, I take it a little personally because, mm-hmm. I mean, you said I'm an actor, campaigner. But actually, Tom, as you know, at the beginning of this, I'm a writer and reporter about it. I wrote the first book about all of this. And I've spent the last quarter century of my life, I would just as soon not have spent it fighting. I would just as soon have spent it looking for solutions to this thing. But because there's been that endless poisoning of the debate, mm-hmm. the ongoing one, and you heard it from Senator Rounds at the beginning of the hour, a man who's taken huge sums of money from the fossil fuel industry, then this fight has to continue. And as long as there's going to be a fight, we're going to do everything we can to win it. What a remarkable thing to watch that huge, broad, diverse coalition emerge that didn't look like people's stereotype of the environmental mm-hmm. movement. Mm-hmm. It looked like something entirely different. It looked like the antibodies of a planet in crisis beginning to kick in and try to come to its defense.
And the president rejecting Keystone XL pipeline on Friday. Ray in North Kingston, Rhode Island. Ray, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. And hi to your guests. I had a 30-year career as a mechanical engineer, and 12 of those were spent in the oil industry.
Okay.
And I think what people have to realize is this tar sands oil is probably the dirtiest, filthiest oil that we could have, and it not very much of it would stay in the United States for energy self-sufficiency. As a taxpayer, I would rather see my money spent on sustainable wind, solar, any of those energy modems than this tar sands.
Ray, you worked in the business. Do you feel the tide turning here with this decision against the fossil fuel production industry?
Absolutely, I think I do, and it's the right direction because we just can't keep destroying this planet with fossil fuels. It's that in itself is non-sustainable.
Ray, I appreciate your call very much. Bill McKibben, where's the next battlefield? This one you won at least for now on Friday. Where's the next front?
Well, there's fronts all over the place. As I say, there's now not a coal mine, frack well, pipeline project that's not being opposed. This divestment campaign is exploding. The pressure to, as we say, keep it in the ground is now all over the planet. So I think that this is, you know, Paris will be not the game so much, but the scoreboard. We'll see how we're doing. We're going to come out of there on a world still careening towards 3 or 3.5 degrees Celsius more warming. We'll have a sense of just how much more we have to do, how much harder we have to fight against this rogue industry.
Coral, what's your assessment on Paris at this point? Copenhagen was a major disappointment for many environmentalists. Does it look like Paris is shaping up for companies to hit the marks on reining in CO2 emissions?
Well, one thing that world leaders are doing on this and that the UN is doing on this is lowering expectations.
Does that mean no? Does that mean the answer is no?
The stated goal of this UN climate change process is to put in place policies that would prevent the warming of the planet over 2 degrees Celsius. That's the point at which scientists say we'll kind of go into a tipping point of significantly melting ice sheets, significantly raising sea levels, major droughts, major food shortages.
So what are you saying? They're already surrendering at Paris?
Well, the proposals that the national plans that have been put forward in Paris will not reach that 2 degree mark. They'll prevent warming up to about between 2.7 and 3.5 degrees. That's better than what it could be. With no action, we could see warming of 4, 5, 6, 7 degrees. So it's seen as a starting point. It won't get us where we need to go. Another thing about Paris is that it will not be a legally binding treaty, and that's because of the U.S. The Congress has made very clear that it will not ratify any new climate change agreement. And so any kind of deal that would require Senate ratification will not happen. So it won't be legally binding. It won't get us where we need to go. It could be a significant first step.
And Bill McKibben, what's your word on this 3 days after the Keystone decision to those who have followed you in this fight?
Plenty more fights to be had, but this is a good sign that the tide has begun finally to turn.
Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, author of Oil and Honey and Earth. Thanks very much for being with us, Bill.
Thank you.
Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Thanks as always, Coral. Great to have you.
Great to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.